And the court will proceed to the fourth case, Rankin v. Gregory. Mr. Olson. One second, Mr. Olson. I want to make sure you... Oh, you have co-counsel here, or opposing counsel.
Morning.
All right, Mr. Olson.
This is a 1983 case that was filed prior to the Garcetti decision, and it was dismissed after the Garcetti decision. The case is rather straightforward in that there is no dispute that Dr. Rankin complained about the defendant's mishandling of public money on summary judgment before the district court, in particular at proposed findings of fact 50 and 51, as well as others cited in the brief. The defendants did not dispute the fact that Dr. Rankin had complained about mishandling of public money. The only issue in this case is whether Dr. Rankin had been officially tasked in his position as a university professor and associate professor with the policing and complaining of the mishandling of the federal money. This court has clarified and discussed the Garcetti decision in its recent decision since Garcetti, in particular in Callahan on May 20th, Morales in 2007, as well as Tuesday's decision in Tamayo. What this court had set out in Tamayo is that in looking at the job duties of the employee, Dr. Rankin, we need to take a practical view of whether the employee is speaking as an employee or as a citizen. In taking a practical view, we must take into account the employee's level of responsibility. In the Tamayo case, that involved a senior administrator of an agency who, in the course of her job, testified before a committee of the legislature charged with oversight of that agency about alleged improper political influence. This court found in that case that Ms. Tamayo was discharging the responsibilities of her office. In the case at hand, Dr. Rankin has no such responsibility. He complained on his own regarding the mishandling of this grant money.
Is teaching and research part of his duties at all?
It is, Your Honor. And teaching is his responsibility. Research is his responsibility.
So I suppose if research is applying for grants and making sure they're implemented appropriately would be part of his duties also, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is, I think, describes the crux of the issue as to how far we expand those official duties. As we're aware, many of these decisions that find protected speech involve employees who work in governmental offices and at agencies. They are speaking during their jobs, during work hours. They're often speaking to their coworkers. They're speaking to their supervisors in the form of protected speech. But what distinguishes this case from those other cases involving official duties is that the defendants have not pointed to any official duty that Dr. Rankin has to report the mishandling of funds. In fact, what the administration expected here is that what Dr. Rankin would go along with them and do whatever they wanted with respect to taking the federal money. In this case, about $30,000 was the ultimate issue. And applying that toward the college's own responsibility under the grant, taking that public money and using it for an improper purpose.
The college was supposed to match it to some degree?
Yes, there are a number of different types of matches. They were to provide the physical bricks and mortar structure. They were to provide course buyouts for the PIs, the primary investigators, in this case, Dr. Rankin.
So the match was not just a matter of fungible dollars. It was specific offsetting things. The college was supposed to do certain things, and the grant was supposed to do other things, and you're saying that he was saying that they were trying to take the money and do what the college was supposed to fund?
Yes, and I think Exhibit 1 is very straightforward in that it's a one-page application with the proposal behind it, and that sets out in a chart form the money that was to be paid by NSF and the money that was to be paid and matched by the college. So there's purchases of equipment. The buyouts, it is actual money in that because this education grant is an overload on the professor's teaching requirements, money is used from the grant and from the school to buy out the professor's responsibilities to teach courses and reduce down their course level so that they can devote their time and efforts to the production of the purpose of the grant.
Well, was he working to make sure the money, I guess you would say, enhanced his own position to make sure that he was getting that type of, I guess you'd say, offset?
Well, I think it would be disingenuous for me to suggest that he did not have some personal interest here. It was a project that he developed. He went to NSF. Dr. Rankin had been a very successful promoter of the college and getting federal funds for the college. And this was a project that he wanted to develop, but the big distinction here is that he didn't go out to get a research grant. This is an education grant. And as I pointed out in my brief, that is where I believe the district court made a serious error in describing this as being within Dr. Rankin's personal interests for personal research. This is an education grant that was to the benefit only indirectly of Dr. Rankin. The direct benefit was derived from the engineering students, by the engineering students, by setting up the grant and the college ultimately in publications and setting this up as a model program for other universities to follow.
It seems like that would be a better argument to make without Garcetti being here. But with Garcetti, which we've given a fairly broad construction to, looking at what his duties were, what his core duties are, and the peripheral duties, it seems to me that this looks like it's within at least the periphery of his responsibilities as an employee.
Your Honor, the responsibility of Dr. Rankin regarding the grant was to set up the project, use the money, work with the college to establish the program, but it did not extend to his filing of the complaints with the university committee, the Board of Regents, the chancellor of the entire system, Nancy Zimpfer, with Abe Nasansi, the official who was in charge of the money. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may, for rebuttal. However, in closing, I would state that in Morales, for example, that case involved a decision by this court that the same language or speech by the employee stated to one person may be unprotected, while that same speech is protected when it goes beyond the official duties. In that case, the distinction was complaining to a boss or supervisor versus describing it in deposition testimony. This court drew the distinction that the deposition was not part of the official duty.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Sahar?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, fellow counsel. This matter is before this court on an appeal of a summary judgment that in favor of the defendants. It's a de novo review. The question before this court involves the interpretation and application of the Supreme Court's holding in Garcetti. The defendant appellants do have other defenses that were raised in the briefs, but I think the key issue is the Garcetti analysis. Importantly, the material facts in this case are not in dispute, and I'll discuss those undisputed facts in just a moment. But the real dispute in this case involves the proper interpretation and application of Garcetti. Dr. Rankin, and you can see from his opening argument today, Dr. Rankin gives a very, very narrow reading, which I suggest is at odds with the holding of Garcetti, the language of Garcetti, and subsequent cases, including decisions from this very court, interpreting Garcetti. As you know, and I don't want to get into a long analysis of Garcetti, but as you know, Garcetti held that when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, they're not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution, therefore, does not insulate their communications from discipline. A court, as Justice Evans suggested in his question, a court must first make a threshold determination of whether an employee spoke as a citizen or spoke pursuant to official duties before moving on to the traditional Pickering analysis. If the employee spoke pursuant to official duties, that employee is not speaking as a citizen, and that speech is thereby not protected. Dr. Rankin's interpretation and our interpretation are very different. He interprets that holding to mean that Garcetti only applies to situations where it's the plaintiff or the employee's official duty to report misconduct or misappropriation of funds. There's repeated references to that interpretation in their brief. In their brief, they argue, unlike the official duty of Garcetti, it was not Dr. Rankin's official duty to speak against misuse of federal money. He argues that Garcetti does not apply because Dr. Rankin's job does not impose a duty to report misappropriation of the NSF grant. He contends that it was not one of Dr. Rankin's official duties to report any alleged misappropriation of federal funds. And we believe and we submit to you today that this is a mistaken reading of Garcetti. That interpretation, I suggest, would basically emasculate the significance of Garcetti, and it would limit the application of Garcetti to those rare and unusual cases where a plaintiff employee has a job that requires him or her to report misconduct or fraud or dishonesty. There's very few jobs where a person has that specific duty. The correct reading of Garcetti is that speech made by employees while performing their official duties is not protected because they're speaking as public employees and not as citizens. In Garcetti, for example, the deputy DA was performing his official duties. He was reviewing a police affidavit that was the basis of a search warrant. Pursuant to performing that duty, or in the course of performing that duty, he expressed his belief that the affidavit contained some serious misrepresentations. Again, pursuant to his job duties, he wrote a disposition memo in which he recommended dismissal of a pending criminal case because of the alleged misconduct.
Now, is all of the speech we're dealing with here internal, meaning just to university officials or in forums in university or something that's within that process, or was it external as well?
It was all internal. As I've indicated in my brief, analytically I tried to separate out the two types of speech. The one type of speech were verbal communications and statements made in memorandums between the dean of the college and Dr. Rankin and Dr. Reisel, or the dean of the graduate school and Dr. Rankin. And a lot of those, a lot of that exchange, which I'm going to get to in a minute, is set forth in the appendix 181 to about 210 or so, 220. The other type of speech that Ms. Dr. Rankin tries to raise is he lodged an internal complaint with the university committee and the faculty rights and responsibilities committee. And again, I'll speak to those in a few moments, but suffice it to say that it's basically undisputed that those complaints to the university committee and the faculty rights and responsibilities complaint committee did not raise an issue related to the NSF grant. And in fact, there are some memos that Dr. Rankin wrote in which he specifically says, we are not raising the NSF grant as part of these complaints or these grievances. And for example, let me address those actual complaints he filed. The first one was to the university committee. June 11, 2002, he complained that Dean Gregory failed to sign off on four personnel action forms. Those are forms needed to pay undergraduate research students. December 5, 2002, he filed a complaint to the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee. And that basically complained about non-processing of two hourly contracts for students, and he had received a disturbing voicemail by a Professor Glass, and he complained about that. And then later on, as I indicated, he specifically he wrote two letters in which he told both of these committees that he's not asking them to inquire about the NSF grant. So those complaints really, I think, are insignificant with respect to a free speech claim. But the speech that he's mainly pushing in this case are there's a couple of memos that he wrote while they were trying to, they hit an impasse in terms of implementing the grant. There was a disagreement over lab space, and there was a disagreement over course release time. And what course release time means is that instead of teaching three courses, a professor is released from one course, an instructor is hired to handle that course in order so that this professor can conduct some research, in this case, work on the grant application. And there were memos, and I think that's what's critical to this case, is seeing where the seeds of the alleged free speech arose. And you can see the speech in the memos that were exchanged. As I indicated, there was a professional disagreement over UWM's cost-sharing obligation. The main dispute was over the lab and the amount of release time. And that's indicated in the letter March 4th, 2002, from Dean Gregory to Professors Rankin and Reisel, Appendix 182. They respond on March 4th and reject that proposal. On May 14th, 2002, Dean Gregory sends them a letter setting forth a proposal to try to resolve the dispute. And he talks about salaries, equipment, release time, and lab space. On May 28th, 2002, Professors Rankin and Reisel again reject the proposal, And it's in that letter that they state that's where the seat of the alleged free speech is. It's in that letter, May 28, 2002, in which they say that the NSF does not allow funds or required matching funds to be used for lab space modifications and utilities. Okay? The whole point of that is, if I can just sidetrack for a second, is what the NSF would be concerned about is if the university gets a grant to run a thermal lab and a university says, hey, what a great opportunity, let's take the money and let's do some bricks and mortar and build a whole new engineering building way beyond what's needed for that specific project. So NSF money can be used. It's like a computer lab or engineering lab. They want it to be used for that specific, but they don't want the capital improvements. They want the university to pay for the large capital expenditures, the capital improvements. On July 26, 2002, what's very interesting is that Dean Gregory responds to their concerns about what the NSF does not allow. And if you look at that memo, Appendix 213 and 214, he actually deletes the provisions that they expressed concerns about. There's two separate deletions. Professors Rankin and Reisel still refused to sign off on it. I'm sorry.
Mr. Sahari, your time is expiring, or has expired, so I'm going to ask you to make your concluding remarks, please.
Okay. What's very compelling in this case, Your Honors, is that Dr. Rankin, all of his speech in those memos were pursuant to performance of his research. Grant implementation is part of research and teaching, and he was making his speech while there were negotiations trying to get over that impasse. And furthermore, his own amended complaint, demonstrates in his own words that all of that was pursuant to his official teaching and research responsibilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Johnson.
To pick up on that last point regarding our amended complaint, the complaint actually discusses responsibilities of Dr. Rankin, not pursuant to his official duties, but what is required under the terms of the grant in getting that public money, in handling that public money. I'd like to address the implication by the defense that the issue was somehow fixed by former Dean Gregory concerning the misappropriation. In fact, that's not the case, and at appendix document 202, it's exhibit 34, on November 1, 2002, Dr. Rayburn stepped in and actually took a huge step backwards, and at that point required that $29,000 in change that was the cost share be applied from the federal money. It was a clear misuse of federal money. It's also not accurate that all of the complaints were internal to the college. At plaintiff's proposed finding of fact, this is document number 64 in the district court's docket, proposed finding of fact 50, the defendants admitted that Dr. Rankin filed several complaints that the defendants were not using the federal money correctly, and one of which was to the National Science Foundation, as I mentioned, Dr. Abe Nassansi. At plaintiff's proposed findings of fact before the district court, number 68, the defendant also did not dispute that the Board of Regents had knowledge of Dr. Rankin's opposition to misuse of public money. Dr. Rankin complained to a number of people, and he got no remedy internally. prior to the return of the public money, the court can remand this case and allow it to proceed to a jury trial by simply finding that Dr. Rankin did not have the official responsibility. He was not tasked with the responsibility to report the misspending of public money. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Thanks both counsel, obviously. And the case.